Welcome, everyone. You're listening to Biotech Hangout, a live and unedited weekly discussion of all the latest news in our industry with a group of biotech insiders. I'm Daphne Zohar, and my co-hosts today are Josh Schimmer, Tim Oppler, Chris Garabedian, John Maraganore, and Ethan Perlstein. For more information about our hosts and guest speakers, or to listen to the most recent episode, please go to biotechhangout.com. So we're going to start with conferences. There were two major investor conferences this week, Stifel and Jefferies, and we also had the American College of Rheumatology and the American Heart Association meetings, which had some newsworthy data. Not sure if anybody else was at Jefferies. I was there. Were any of you guys there?
It's more of a public equity conference. So as a VC, my team doesn't attend, but the Perceptive team was out there talking to a lot of public company CEOs like yourself, Daphne.
Yeah, so what was interesting about it, I think the Jefferies conference in London, it was very busy. There was over 3,000 people there. And what struck me about the conference, actually over the last few years, is that the networking starts on the plane and you're hearing snippets of biotech jargon in the streets of London. There's a lot of receptions. You bump into people you know in the atrium of the Waldorf, which is similar to how it is with the clock at JPM. And they were so busy, they had to get overflow space for the meetings. Unlike JPM in San Francisco, as you point out, Chris, there's not a lot of VCs that go there. And the hotels and restaurants are still reasonably priced. So my one sort of beef with the conference, with both of those conferences, is that they're in these old hotels with tiny elevators. So you're running up and down flights of stairs between presentations and meetings. But generally, I thought it was great that it was so well attended and a lot of investors there. Sentiment still seems very negative, despite some good news on inflation and interest rates. And I'd like to open it up to the group to talk about just general biotech sentiment, what you guys are hearing, and any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I'll start, Daphne. I mean, I think Biotech Hangout tweeted out the third quarter performance of kind of the highest profile hedge funds, including the firm I work for, Perceptive. And I have to say, it was, I mean, really eye-opening to see that the specialty biotech hedge funds are still struggling. Now, there's been a rebound on the XBI, you know, in the beginning part of, you know, since that Q3 result. But I think we're all still keeping an eye on public valuations and the XBI. And again, we all remain very hopeful and waiting for feeling like we're out of the woods. But yeah, I think there's still this feeling that until we're really out of it, there's some uncertainty of exactly when we're going to get to that healthy state.
But that said, I if I can just jump in, Chris, I'm hearing investors getting a sense of green shoots coming up at this point. Now, you know, let's see if that sticks and happens for real. And it still might be another 12 months, as we all know, but there are some good signs. And I'm hearing that from investors.
That's great. Public investors or private?
Both.
That's good to hear. Josh, any thoughts, Ethan, before we move on?
Yeah, sure. I mean, biotech's back to where it was 5 or 6 years ago. Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that the broader macro influences on the sector have been quite powerful, both on the way up, on the way and on the way down. If you correlate the XBI with, you know, 10-year the 10-year notes or the money supply, you know, again, from that perspective, it's pretty clear what's going on. But it also looks very clear that we're towards the end of the collapse of the bubble. And it looks like things are starting to stabilize and, you know, a stable biotech tape is an important biotech tape for stock picking, which this is always and forever going to be a stock picker sector, because of the binary element of it. And as we've talked about before, I think they're just dozens and dozens and dozens of very compelling entry points in biotech as a result of the bubble's collapse and the few years of a pain trade that we've had to endure as a result of the years of a bubble that we enjoyed. So it definitely feels like we're coming out on the other side. A lot of the macro indicators are starting to stabilize as well, which is important. The innovation is, as always, better than it's ever been. And I'd say it's also more orderly than it's ever been, which is another good indicator for the sector as we look forward. So I'm as optimistic and enthusiastic for the sector as I've ever been, but also, always with a caveat of you can't talk about biotech like it's one homogeneous entity. Right? It really is a stock picker market.
Yeah. Tim, you have been analyzing the sector and when you think it might potentially turn around. Curious, first of all, how was Stifel? How was sentiment there? Any themes that stood out to you?
Yeah, so the Stifel conference last week, you know, was very busy. Brisk, I think, probably similar to the Jefferies conference. We definitely had, Josh, I think you just said it very well, you know, stuff is getting done. It's very professional, orderly, and so on. So it felt that way. Transactions are happening. Companies are, you know, everyone's getting, you know, good meetings with investors and that sort of thing. The sentiment that I heard was probably not as positive as on this call. So I think there was still quite a lot of negative sentiment expressed by investors at the conference. So I agree with all the comments that are being made that we're sort of at the turning point in a down cycle, but you know, I don't think most people have got that memo yet. And you know, hopefully, you know, in time that will become more and more evident.
Any themes that stood out to you in terms of generalists and coming back in, and anything else that stood out to you?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, if anything, we're seeing generalists still exiting the market. So if you look at the specialists in the market, especially the hedge funds that are, you know, most active and participating in all these pipes this week, we saw a bunch of them. The specialists, I think, are tending to go more long right now and also coming off the sidelines. So a lot of specialists have been sitting, you know, a fair bit in cash, and so they're coming back into the market. We're actually still not seeing generalists coming in, and if you go through a lot of the, you know, 13G filings and various filings that have come out in recent weeks, if anything, it feels like the generalist long investors have still been pulling back from the market. And, you know, they will come back as all the factors we're talking about today start to manifest themselves more clearly. There was another theme that I would highlight, which is, you know, last week, unfortunately, we saw negative data from Aclaris. And so this is like the fourth or fifth sort of I&I disappointment in a row. And so a common conversation with investors was, okay, what do we do besides just cardiometabolic? You know, cardiometabolic is, you know, long and strong right now, but what else should we be looking at? And, you know, our analyst, Paul Matisse, who I know has appeared a couple of times on Biotech Hangout, of course, he was saying, well, neuroscience is going to be a real bright spot in 2024. And so, you know, I hope he's right. And, you know, investors right now are kind of looking for an evolving theme in the market.
Yeah. So Josh, the American College of Rheumatology annual conference wrapped up this week, and CAR T cell therapy data in autoimmune disease was a big focus of the meeting. I know you were watching for that. So what stood out for you?
Yeah, I guess the most important thing that stood out for me was at a rheumatology conference that features nearly every major large biopharmaceutical company on the planet. What really did steal the show was the sessions on the CAR T platforms for autoimmune diseases. Very, very well attended. Lots of engagement and interest. Even though they're all still very early in development. I think at this point we've seen data for, you know, at most 24 patients and at most 36 patients treated. But, you know, the obvious point is that the outcomes that we're seeing with these CAR T therapies are just so unprecedented in terms of both efficacy and then balanced with the tolerability profile, that perhaps not surprising that these therapies are being talked about as potentially transformative for the field, and just a tremendous amount of unmet need that can be addressed across a number of different diseases, ranging from lupus nephritis, scleroderma, myositis, and different subsets of myositis. There was some data presented for myasthenia gravis, which looked truly exceptional. So really something early and potentially incredibly powerful happening. Clear that there are two companies that are really moving fastest in terms of filing INDs and having as expansive a trial program as possible. That's Cabaletta, and then a private company called Kyverna. And then there are a couple of other companies in the mix, not quite moving as fast, and that speed to market and expansion of indications is going to be very important. There are some interesting nuances that we're seeing in the autoimmune disease space that we didn't necessarily see for CAR T in oncology, including the fact that the B cells recover fairly quickly, unlike what is being seen in the oncology setting. So that's an interesting point to note, perhaps suggesting that in autoimmunity, one doesn't need the same depletion of B cells that or quite as deep suppression and depletion of B cells as you need in the oncology setting. Interesting to see that immune protection against viruses and such, like the protective immunity from vaccines is preserved in the autoimmune setting, which may also suggest that you don't need quite as deep suppression and targeting, or I should say depletion of B cells. All sorts of other interesting nuances, but it's really exciting to see this new platform move into the autoimmune space, taking all the learnings from the years that they were being developed in oncology, and potentially bring truly transformational therapies. So, very exciting conference from that perspective, and I expect in the years ahead, it's just going to be an expanding explosion of activity as more companies are enrolling patients across different settings and reporting data and moving into all sorts of other disease indications, which right now are just on paper and in theory, but it's very hard to imagine that the CAR T therapies are only going to apply to the four diseases that they've worked incredibly in so far and stop there. I'm quite confident that they're gonna have fairly broad applicability in B cell, maybe T cell disorders. And then we're also starting to see the NK cell players, you know, who struggled in the oncology setting, dipping their toes into the autoimmune setting as well, with the hopes that, again, maybe in oncology, they don't quite pack as strong a punch as needed. Whereas in immunology, perhaps it's a softer punch that's required, and they can compete there. So still lots of things happening in this field. Going to be very exciting for the months and years ahead.
Tim, did you want to comment?
Yeah, just really like your comments, Josh, and I agree with you. I mean, companies like Cabaletta are just incredibly exciting right now. And, you know, as I speak with investors and, you know, again, people are kind of like looking around, all right, so I own my structured therapeutics, now what? I keep saying B-cell. So I&I is not a, you know, uniform giant field. It's actually a whole bunch of fields. And what we're seeing is both the FcRn class, we're seeing these CAR Ts really looking good in B-cell, but there's also a lot of new stuff popping up in B-cell, like Biohaven's IgG degrader. And so I keep, you know, talking with investors and saying, you know, this is a really good time to get very smart about B-cell biology, because I think we're going to be looking at, you know, a good couple of decades of innovation in B-cell-based autoimmune disease.
Yeah, I'm with you, Tim. And I think one of the unanswered questions that we're all keen to see is what is the scope of B cell diseases? Is rheumatoid arthritis a B cell disease in response to rituxan? Right? Lupus isn't necessarily considered a pure B cell disease. And to what extent can CAR T therapies move into diseases that are generally considered T cell disorders, which would unlock basically the rest of the mega immunology market for these approaches and for related approaches?
Very interesting. And I think, you know, no one's really written about this. Maybe this is a good topic for one of us one of these days, but my casual impression is that there's at least 100 diseases, maybe 200 or 300 that are phenotypically linked to auto antibody expression. So it feels like it's just absolutely massive. It's going to be very interesting to see, you know, like a Cabaletta or a Kyverna, how they end up competing against Argenics next 5 or 10 years. I think the field is going to become one of the biggest stories in biotech.
Yeah. So let's shift gears and talk about some of the deals this week. First of all, I want to congratulate you, Chris, on the $620 million Forge Ajinomoto acquisition, which was one of the biggest gene therapy transactions we've seen this year. You're on the board of Forge. I think you're also an investor. Tell us a little bit about the deal.
Yeah, so we actually led the Series A back in middle of 2020 out of our first fund. And look, any VC will tell you the best they can hope for is a straight cash M&A deal. It's just the cleanest. You know, if you have a company go public, we had two of our investments go public this year. Cargo, one of the CAR-T companies, we led the Series A with Third Rock and RTW. And earlier, we were mezzanine investors in Apogee earlier this year. But when you have a company go public, you still have to almost operate like a public equity fund, right? When do you sell? How much do you hold? Do you wait for catalysts? So when you have an M&A that happens, you know, in this case, within a little more than 3 years, it's always nice to see in this market. You know, we've looked at well over 100 gene therapy companies, and you know, there's a lot of challenges in having confidence that it will translate into the clinic. But we felt that there were so many gene therapy programs that were moving forward that they would all have to have good GMP manufacturing and a lot of early programs that would need companies like Forge. So that ended up being a good bet, even though the CDMO space has, you know, definitely seen a lot of new entries in the last several years. So just a shout out to the CEO, Tim Miller, who was the former CEO of Abeona. He built an amazing team. The facility that was just a warehouse when we invested is really a top tier facility. And so we were really pleased and felt it was the right time. I mean, one of the things about gene therapy manufacturing, and I would say this goes broadly to any service firm, is, you know, you want a constant renewal of a pipeline of potential clients. And in the last couple of years, we really didn't see as much new money coming in to create new gene therapy companies. And even companies that were already in gene therapy, we saw them rationalize their pipelines, cut down on the number of programs that they were moving forward, saw valuations really decrease. So we thought that this was the right time to sell to a partner that could have a longer term view and really help scale up. So yeah, we were really pleased to see that exit. And in this environment, any LPs in a venture fund, they want to see a check back for their investment. And so anytime you can get a, you know, money back to your LPs in this environment is a good thing.
Yeah, congratulations. So we had some big regulatory news this week with CRISPR and Vertex getting the first regulatory authorization of a CRISPR-based gene editing therapy in the world for their CRISPR-Cas9 sickle cell disease treatment, Casgevy, in the UK. I guess they're also awaiting an FDA decision for sickle cell in December. They have a PDUFA date there. So I'd like to ask John and Ethan, what are your thoughts on this milestone?
Maybe I can start. I mean, obviously, it's just a huge milestone for the whole field. I mean, it's stunning to think that it's taken a little bit over 6 years to go from the foundational discoveries of CRISPR-Cas9 based editing from, you know, Doudna and then Fang Zhang and others to now have the first regulatory approval, albeit of an ex vivo based medicine. But it just really amazing speed and stunning to see it happen so quickly. And it's obviously going to be a very, very transformative medicine for people with sickle. The news is not out yet fully on pricing, and that'll be another part of the story to get right. And hopefully Vertex and CRISPR are thinking about it the right way. But it is regardless a truly incredible milestone for science and a whole new frontier of medicine that, you know, will have, I think, more hits in the future, almost certainly. And this is the first one, you know, at least in the MH, at least in the UK, but I expect soon in the US. And it's a big one. It's a big one.
Hey, John, let me ask you, I mean, I think a lot of companies would try to sequence their approvals where they could maximize pricing. And given that it hasn't been announced, any thoughts on having a price point out there from NICE and the UK, and then having to justify potentially a larger premium in the US? You know, it's usually not the ideal sequence of approvals, but you can't kind of pull back if you have an approval in hand.
Well, I mean, Chris, as you know, the process of reimbursement in the UK is lengthy, and access won't even be available in the UK even if everything goes swimmingly well, which I'd be skeptical. It'll be swimmingly well, but it'll take some time, 12 to 24 months. So I think Vertex is doing the right thing to hold their cards close to their chest until they get the US approval, and then obviously introduce the right value proposition. There are some constructive ICER views on value here that I think could be helpful, but it doesn't change the dynamic that I think will exist in the payer world, especially with Medicaid programs at the state level, where, I think these type of medicines will, be found to be challenging. And it would be unfortunate if it creates greater health inequities, you know, in the population that they've recently gained the approval for. So I'm hopeful that Vertex and CRISPR, and I'm sure they have been very, very thoughtful, knowing the people that are at those companies, very, very thoughtful about all these issues. And I look forward to hearing how they're thinking about pricing. But I don't think we'll hear about it until probably the U.S. approval or thereabouts.
Yep.
I just wanted to echo everything John said and maybe nerd out for a few moments here about the science. I mean, the story here is pretty incredible, and in some ways analogous to SMA, where you kind of activate a backup gene. And so obviously beta thalassemias, these are a type of sickle cell, but these are specifically mutations in beta globin. And you need to have a balance between beta and alpha globin. Otherwise, you get hemolysis and sickling. So the therapeutic thesis is, can you restore the balance or basically return beta globin levels so that you now have beta and alpha in balance? And, you know, this really, I want to kind of give a shout out to Vamsi Mutha, who had a little tweet about this and sort of summarize a lot of the science that went into it that I want to unpack here for a second, but I want to acknowledge a person named Janet Watson, who 70 years ago, very serendipitously, observed that there were few symptoms in infants with sickle cell disease who had high fetal hemoglobin levels in their blood. So this idea that fetal hemoglobin could be a suppressor and can essentially compensate for the mutation in beta globin in the adult form of the gene, that was an insight that was made 70 years ago. And then Vamsi's tweet led to another tweet by a researcher who was the first author on a paper from 2008 in Stuart Orkin's lab, Vijay Sankaran. This is the paper where they show that there are differences in genetic variants that can control the expression of the fetal hemoglobin gene, BCL11A. And then, of course, using CRISPR, that's the coup de grace here, you could now very selectively react, you could tinker with the promoter of the BCL11A fetal hemoglobin gene, and you could reactivate it with this very elegant CRISPR move. So I just want to, you know, that paper was from 2008, where they proposed this therapeutic thesis. The original serendipitous observation in humans was 70 years ago. So just wanting to acknowledge that you know, a lot of amazing science went into this, but still, I think the fact that we go from 2008 to today with this CRISPR technology and this really almost, you know, very elegant modality disease fit, you can now hopefully also serve a population of folks who have been suffering without really great options, and folks also who don't necessarily get all the attention demographically from the farm industry historically. So yeah, this is a great victory lap for the industry, I think.
You know, and it's interesting not to triple down on the scientific deep dive, but it really is an interesting
John,
example.
That would be geekery.
What's that? I'm sorry.
That would be geekery.
Oh, geekery. Yes, not to triple down on the geekery. Thank you. But it really is a fantastic example of the convergence of the emergence of a new modality with the relatively recent discovery around biology and pathophysiology, which just makes it very particularly exciting, because you wouldn't really be able to do this before. I mean, notwithstanding the great discoveries, you wouldn't be able to do this before you had the emergence of this new modality. So it's just a great story all the way around. It's supreme geekery for sure.
So in somewhat related news, at the American Heart Association meeting, Verve presented data that excited scientists and clinicians. So lots of geekery, but investors were less enthusiastic. So John and Ethan, can you discuss the data and why you think the company's stock dipped 40% after these clinical results that they reported?
Well, I think the data here are also pretty remarkable. I mean, this is now the first time in a human being that we are seeing the ability of changing a specific base in the DNA. I mean, let's just all take a step back and reflect on what has been achieved here by Verve, which is really remarkable. I mean, just being able to enter a human body and target the DNA and change a single base in the DNA of a human. That's what's just occurred. So it is a stunning piece of science. And obviously the data on PCSK9 lowering and LDL cholesterol lowering in the heterozygous FH population was actually very competitive with what's been out there with other modalities, including the ones I love, like RNAi. So it's really very much in the sweet spot. Of course, you know, I think there was anxiety around the safety reports that came out, and that I think led to anxieties around the profile of the program from investors and so forth. But you know, it really hearkened, and I commented on this in an Endpoints article. I made some comments in. You know, it really harkens back to some of our journey at Alnylam with RNAi, where you know sometimes you take the prototype approach into the clinic, into man, you learn from it and you cycle back and make it better. And so as I go from, you know, Verve 101 to 102, which is a better LNP framework, especially in the heterozygous FH population, I'm hopeful that they will see, improvements. So I think it's too soon to be anxious. I think obviously it is a milestone by all accounts. And I look forward to seeing how the story continues under their stewardship.
I might have a more contrarian take on this. I have no arguing about the technical feat that was accomplished. I think what I kind of noticed from my corner of Twitter was that there seemed to be a very strong kind of consensus emerging. And when I see that happening, I always look to see who is sort of going against that consensus, who has a contrarian point of view. And I'll just highlight a cardiologist named Dr. Van Murphy, who I think, you know, through his Substack, which is called Numerical Heart, he had a post that came out that day on the 13th this week, entitled Time for Revision on Gene Editing for Cholesterol. And so I would hope people would take a look at that and maybe take what may be considered, I guess, a contrarian point of view, but a different point of view, where maybe a harder look at the data, a harder look at the fact that two of the 10 patients had severe cardiac complications, including one case that had it one day after receiving the drug. So I think there's no argument this is a technical feat. And in a world where we have this proliferation of modalities, I think we can expect that, you know, there probably won't be one modality to rule them all. And I think that's actually best for patients, because as people may know, that's sort of my thesis, that they're the platform and the companies are gonna have to fight for body share and mind share. And the best modality will win. And we want most diseases to have multiple options. So I think it's great as a technical feat. I think other people have talked about the commercial sort of implications here when you have competing therapies that appear, at least by the efficacy, by knockdown of LDL levels. You see very comparable drugs, including RNAi acting drugs that, you know, gee, you have to go twice a year. I guess there is an attraction to one and done, but I think it's good that other people are sort of maybe pushing back on this concept of why are we just sort of all accepting blindly this concept of one and done when we should have a real competition between these modalities. And let's see over many years who proved, which ones proved to be the safest and most effective.
Yeah, I'll just add a little bit to this.
Ethan, I'm gonna keep taking my inclisiran, just to be clear. Yeah. But I think it's great that there can be and will be emergence of options. It is a very big market ultimately, and there are segments where different patient populations could benefit from different options that become available over time.
Yeah, I'll just add, and John, you're a testament to really highlight the patience you need in development and to allow a technology and data sets to mature. For me, and I'm not as close to this, I did follow a little bit of the Twitter back and forth, but I mean, at its root, it's 10 patients, two, I believe, were tested at the higher dose that they described as the more therapeutic, and the treatment-related, so it was identified as treatment-related adverse effects. So what I didn't see enough of is highlighting that this is a small data set. This is not an ultra rare disease population, right, where this number of patients treated. And I think, from my assessment, it just does seem to have some questions around the therapeutic window. And if you did see more patients treated, what does that risk benefit profile really look like? So I wasn't too surprised by the trade, because I would have expected that this would have to have been a pristine, almost perfect data set. Now, we all like ceftriaxone. I think we're all rooting for Verve in these new technologies. Again, a man in the arena, I think, we're all recognizing the challenges, but we have to remember the scale of this study. And while there is some good technical, efficacy here, it's still a small early stage data set.
Yeah. And speaking of much larger data sets, we had the other big news at AHA was data from Novo Select Phase 3 cardiovascular outcomes trial, looking at the effects of Wegovy injection in adults with established cardiovascular disease. The results were simultaneously published in the New England Journal of Medicine. So I'd love to hear everybody's thoughts. Maybe John, you can go first on the data and response to it.
I mean, wow. 20% reduction in all-cause mortality in the study is just a stunning result. And it just seems that there's no bounds or limits to where the benefits of the GLP-1s may go. So it really was an incredible study result, with associated benefits, of course, on morbidity as well. But to me, the 20% reduction in all-cause mortality was all you needed to see to know how important that study was. So we're really seeing a remarkable, and we're going to see more data in NASH in the years to come as well, but we're really seeing a remarkable category emerge, probably more than we've ever seen before in this industry, I would argue. And it's going to be very, very exciting to see how it develops beyond this point.
Anyone else want to comment?
Just that the data were, extraordinary. And, some commentators said, well, hey, it didn't actually change that much in terms of absolute risk, but this was a population that's already very well served. And so we just saw, three or four years of data. So presumably over a long period of time, there would be, really quite profound benefits. To me, one of the most interesting aspects of the study was, even though it was presented at a heart conference, the relative risk reduction in respiratory disease and some of the other non-cardiac diseases was actually higher. It was not emphasized by the authors, given that they were at AHA, but these obesity drugs, have really profound and broad health effects. And it's just very exciting, I think, for our society, given, I think two in three Americans
Yeah, Tim, you've noted the case Novo's made for these drugs and Alzheimer's, which will be very interesting when we get that data in 2025. I think another lens to look at this through is just the enormity of the unmet need in obesity and some of the projections of the revenue that Lilly and Novo and the other players will be accruing in the coming years. You know, as we think about resource allocation and percent of GDP to spend on biopharmaceuticals, you know, that's gonna force that number higher. And so, you know, where will those savings come from to spend on these obesity drugs? Are they going to come within the biopharmaceutical industry, in which case you can portend another round of targeted effects on drug pricing? Perhaps, you know, arguably, maybe the IRA negotiations are going to have to be more draconian against the larger drugs to make room for this class and you know, related therapeutics, or will the cost savings have to come from other parts of the economy, which, you know, it's always hard to do, and biopharma is frequently a target for the regulators. So it'd be interesting to see the effect that this class has on the rest of the biopharma ecosystem.
You know, Josh, I think it's a really, really interesting point, and one that I've been thinking a lot about as well. And you know, I do think that the public health benefits of what we're seeing from this class could be enormous. The long-term cost reductions could greatly outweigh the expenses of these pharmaceutical products when you think about the morbidities associated with these diseases. And then I did find it particularly interesting that Lilly's launch price for Zepbound, which got approved, was it 2 weeks ago now, was actually lower. And so there's already some element of price reduction that we're seeing in the category, even though arguably they could have, and probably in years past, would have considered a higher price given the performance of the drug. So I think it'll be an interesting thing, area to watch. And I do think we have to be cautious about the negative effects of it that you're pointing out as well. But I wouldn't jump to that yet, because I think there are market factors that may weigh rationally here, in the whole mix. And the only other thing I'll say is I wish we had this type of innovation for climate change, because that would be really special if we can solve that with, something as good as the semaglutide class.
Yeah, no doubt. I would note, though, that, you know, we had the same arguments around hepatitis C. We've got the same arguments around gene therapy for hemophilia, that the cost benefit is quite favorable, and yet the system always strains, when new large therapeutics are introduced, despite those arguments. So it's kind of an ongoing battle between the pharma industry and the policymakers.
Josh, FDA is holding an AdCom today to discuss Merck's chronic cough treatment. You've been following this one. Curious to get your thoughts and also touch on the Bellus GSK program.
Yes, I don't have the AdCom up in front of me, so I'm not quite sure how it's going. But the FDA briefing documents, not too surprising. They were questioning, you know, whether the magnitude of benefit with Merck's P2X3 inhibitor justified approval, and that's kind of what they want the panel to opine on. It's kind of like a 15% reduction in cough, which the question is, would you notice if you were coughing 15% more or less? Probably not if you're a chronic cougher. Bellus, which, you know, was acquired by GSK, I think it's now about a year ago, if I'm not mistaken, for around $2 billion, had a much more selective P2X3 inhibitor, and they designed their trials quite thoughtfully, having learned some of the lessons from the players that were in front of them, such as Merck and Shionogi and Bayer, and really focused in on the patients with higher cough frequency at baseline. And their benefit was more in the 35% range, which probably now starting to move into the much more noticeable benefit for patients. They also were able to capture some patient-reported outcomes that were favorable for Bellus as well. So, this was an event that was going to be closely watched from the Bellus lens, but now it's from a GSK lens. It doesn't quite have the same proportionate importance on valuation. So it'll be interesting to see how the panel votes and what they decide. Probably does not have a substantial read-through to the GSK program just because of much different profile there. And then there's another interesting company out there called Trevi that has extended-release nalbuphine, which is actually having, even a much stronger impact on cough than the P2X3 inhibitors. They're off the radar screens, but have generated some pretty interesting data themselves.
Yeah, and Jennifer Good is she's great, and obviously Roberto Bellini has been a guest of this show as well. So some great people who have driven some of these programs forward. Chris, Astellas announced the acquisition of a prostate cancer treatment program being developed by Propella Therapeutics for $175 million. What did you think of this deal?
Yeah, well, we looked at this one very closely, and we were close to leading their Series A. And I think this is a case where we should really be celebrating this acquisition as an industry. We were awaiting another investor, and a lot of investors looked at this to come in. And Tim, you may know some of the inside baseball on this, but we felt that they needed to generate a phase two data set in order for others to recognize the true value here. This is a company that was developing a prodrug of abiraterone, which is also known as Zytiga, which is now generic. So prostate cancer, big cancer market. Zytiga, was a multi-billion dollar product. And essentially developing this potent inhibitor of CYP17 lyase and hydroxylase. But they were really targeting the lymphatic system and lymph nodes, which really conferred a lot of benefit in that they had some early clinical data, phase one, that showed that they preferentially inhibit this CYP17 lyase, which is the desired target of Zytiga. They delivered identical blockade of the androgens, as Zytiga, without some of the upstream negative effects of the steroid changes of hydroxylase and the cortisol pathway. So they had early data signals, and ultimately they did not pursue their Series A. In this market, there was a lot of skepticism and a lot of concern about how you drive value and waiting for the phase two data set. To their credit, they had some discussions with strategics and ultimately found a buyer at $175 million. And I think there's a lot of investors, including ourselves, feeling like, wow, we let that one get away because it was a strong management team, really good scientific thesis, and maybe underestimating the willingness of a company to step up. And obviously, Astellas had kind of synergy to bring to the table in this space. But again, very novel mechanism. And Tim, you can comment, but also Daphne, I know this is similar to targeting the lymph nodes and lymphatic system for a company in a different space that you're in, looking at Fragile X, ataxias, and other mood disorders in the neurology area. But so again, I think this maybe is a validation of this type of delivery approach. But yeah, I'm really thrilled for the Propella team, strong team, and that they got this acquisition done on essentially some promising phase one data.
And Chris, just to comment a little bit, I think when one looks at potential investments from the investor lens, there's I think a tendency to sort of level set against sort of comparables. So what do other companies look like this trade for? What are we looking for? What is good? What is not good? And sometimes there are just companies that are a really strong strategic fit for someone out there. And that changes things kind of fundamentally. And probably Propella ended up going where it should have gone, which is to a very logical strategic buyer. Astellas, obviously, they have this Xtandi patent expiry coming up. You know, it's interesting that the prostate space in general in this class is still very much alive. So this is obviously one great example. Last year, we also advised on a pretty interesting transaction in the same space between Orion and Merck. I think Merck paid like $290 million up front. You know, I think to some investors, the space looks kind of tired and done and getting ready to be genericized. And so one always has to be very, I would say, just deliberate and thoughtful as you sort of parse through the scientific mechanism and the strategic buyer side on these types of things.
Congrats, Tim, on being part of that transaction. Daphne, you released data with, again, a unique lymph node delivery technology. Do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, thank you. First of all, congrats to Propel. It's a really cool technology. And I love the fact, Chris, that you acknowledge passing on a deal. I think that not enough investors talk about like why they passed and, you know, when things go well later, acknowledge the fact that they didn't go ahead with it. So I really like the fact that you did that. So while both have a lymphatic targeting component, the Propel technology is an injection into muscle that slowly releases drug from a depot, which can travel through the lymphatic vessels that drain that injection site, but it's really kind of like a slow release depot type of technology. The Glyph platform that we're developing at PureTech allows small molecule drugs to be administered orally and absorbed like dietary lipids in the form of prodrugs, which go through the gut draining lymphatics to enter systemic circulation. So the prodrug basically bypasses the liver and avoids first pass liver metabolism. The result is greatly increased oral bioavailability. It can also be applied to circumvent hepatotoxicity. The data we announced showed nice proof of concept for both our Glyph platform and also LYT-300, which is an oral prodrug of endogenous allopregnanolone. So the study that we ran was a randomized placebo-controlled phase 2A acute anxiety trial in 80 healthy volunteers, and it was designed to evaluate an objective biomarker of stress, salivary cortisol response, in something called the Trier social stress test, which is kind of an interesting clinical model. So yeah, we were really happy with it. We met our primary endpoint with a p-value of 0.0001, treatment effect size of 0.72, which is similar effect size to previously observed results for alprazolam, which is a benzodiazepine indicated for treatment of anxiety disorders. You know, so I think we were really happy with it. We've been, I think, just kind of zooming out, this concept of taking drugs that and mechanisms that had previously shown some efficacy but had been held back by issues that you can now kind of overcome with new technology, new drug delivery technology. I think that's really interesting for the industry at large. So I'd love to sort of just zoom out for a second and talk a little bit about that. And, you know, the idea that there are drugs that have that get to human proof of concept but are sitting on a shelf because they have some issue like hepatotoxicity and the potential application of technologies like this one.
Daphne, agree. And, you know, just want to make a comment that, you know, especially in this post-COVID period, anxiety is a massive issue in our country. And, you know, patients don't have a lot to pick from. So, you know, alprazolam, as you said, I mean, that's a benzo, right? So here you have a drug with a much better adverse event profile, and you're using very thoughtful approach from a drug design perspective to, you know, design out the adverse events for these patients. So I agree. Sometimes you don't have to have some brilliant new chemical entity. Sometimes it's more of a matter of the engineering aspects of the delivery of the drug or how the drug is, you know, works through the system that's going to really matter.
Yeah, and it's one of my favorite investment themes of, I call it better mousetraps for lack of a better descriptive term, but you know, you validated a target, you validated an approach, and now you're looking to optimize it with superior delivery, superior medicinal chemistry, et cetera, which is where you tend to find the lowest risk, high reward opportunities. Daphne, how are you thinking about developing in the anxiety space? We've seen a couple of different trial designs and approaches. Some of them are more intuitive. Some of them are a little bit less intuitive as we think about ultimately addressing some large unmet medical needs.
Yeah, so we haven't guided to specifics regarding how we're going to move forward. But, you know, I think what's interesting here is that allopregnanolone has demonstrated an effect in depression and could have broader antidepressant effects. We see an opportunity for this in patients with anxiety who also have symptoms of depression. So a trial could look, for example, at a primary endpoint for anxiety like the HAM-A, but include patients with a particular HAM-D score, which would then be a secondary endpoint. And so, like, you know, we're still in the process of finalizing trial design, and we'll say more about that. But I think that, you know, as mentioned, anxiety is a huge need, and usually is comorbid with, you know, anxiety and depression are comorbid conditions. And so the ability to have something that might have an impact on both, an immediate effect, and all of those things are exciting for us. So, yeah, I want to be cognizant of time. We had a few other deals that we were going to talk about. I was curious to hear from you, Tim. There was a few reverse merger, bio-bio kind of merger deals this week. Do you want to talk about them?
Yep. I think this was probably the biggest week in history for reverse mergers in biotech. And, you know, we're all talking about the need to consolidate our sector and kind of clean it up as we hopefully go into this rally period. So, you know, perfect timing. So Selecta merged with a company called Cartesian Therapeutics. Josh, you must love this one. So they're doing CAR T therapies for myasthenia gravis. And interestingly, the approach is through RNA engineering of the CAR T. So very interesting approach. The company raised $60 million as a PIPE led by Tim Springer, who's a member of the board of Selecta. Graphite Bio, and as a merger with an eye company called Lens Therapeutics, which is a really interesting company. They have excellent data in presbyopia. That company also ended up doing a PIPE deal and has $225 million in cash, which will allow Lens to go forward and to launch its product for presbyopia, an area of big unmet need. Homology Medicines did also a reverse merger into Q32, which has an anti-IL-7 receptor alpha antibody. And they are going to end up with $115 million in cash, also supplemented by a PIPE. Just to make a couple comments, first is effectively all three of these deals were sort of like IPOs in disguise, right? So all three of these companies, I think, are pretty high quality companies and, you know, could have done IPOs should the IPO market be open. And all three of them obviously brought in those pipes, which you could think of as sort of like that IPO money. What was interesting to me is Selecta's stock went up 26%. So you rarely see a stock rise on one of these reverses. Usually the stock goes down. Interestingly, the CEO of Selecta stayed in place and a board member of Selecta actually sponsored the pipe. So this was kind of almost more of a restart for Selecta than a true reverse. Graphite stock, you know, was flat for the week. Really strong company that they merged into, and the Graphite shareholders kept a third of the company. I believe our friend Bruce Booth sits on the board of Graphite. So, again, that one seems like just very well done. Homology stock, despite the fact that Q32 is a really interesting company, so IL-7RA has been a very tough target, and does look like Q32 has a good approach, but Homology stock was down 44%, which is actually a more typical response to a reverse merger announcement.
That's interesting. By the way, Bruce is coming out with his annual year in review, and we were hoping it would be out this morning so he could come talk about it, but I don't think I saw it yet. So he'll have to come on another week to talk about it. It's always really a good analysis. There were a few other deals as well. Alkermes spinning out its oncology business, finishing that up, and it's a publicly traded new entity called Ural Oncology. And they have about $275 million in funding from Alkermes. And then there was another deal. Kite expanded their partnership with Arcellx with $200 million in equity and $85 million in cash. So those were sort of interesting deals this week. Before we go, I'm going to ask everybody to make any closing remarks. I just wanted to share that Biotech Hangout will be taking a break next week as we celebrate Thanksgiving. So I'll invite my colleagues to make some closing remarks, and thank you everyone for the great discussions.
Yeah, just one comment. And John, I know you've been very close with her. I've had very favorable interactions, but the announcement of Janet Woodcock's retirement after almost 40 years at the FDA, I think it's the end of an era. And I think she really was a good steward for decades, really, for the responsibility she had at the FDA. So I think she'll be missed by a lot in industry.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Chris. She's a legend, and her legacy will live on for a long time. But she, I know she personally wants to take it easy. She's lasted there. She was begged by multiple commissioners to stay in the seat during their tenure, and she deserves a break now. And I wish her all the best.
Just want to wish all of you listening a happy Thanksgiving. I think today's hangout has illustrated that we have a lot to be thankful for.
Yeah, I'd echo that. There's, you look around and see what's going on in the world. We are so fortunate to be surrounded by thoughtful, intelligent, cordial, kind, good-hearted people doing amazing work. It's been a tough couple of years for the biotech sector, but on a relative basis, it's to Tim's point, we all have so much to be thankful for, including this forum.
And I think we're all going to be pleasantly surprised by amazing breakthroughs that are going to be happening, hopefully on a weekly basis moving forward. Because I think this is this moment we're in biotech, but I think we should also at the same time always be able to form our own opinions and beware the PR clickbait industrial complex, beware the pseudonymous buy-side analyst on Twitter, where we have to focus on the science and the technical feats and the commercial stuff will work itself out. And it's good that modalities will have to compete for body share. That's going to be a win for patients all around. So yeah, looking forward to Thanksgiving next week and hope everyone enjoys theirs as well.
Yeah, I'm grateful for all of you and for this discussion and wish you all a happy Thanksgiving. And I'll ask John to make the last remark.
Well, I just want to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving and really excited about where this industry is going as well. To Ethan's point, it's an exciting, exciting time, no doubt.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thanks, all.
Thanks. Bye.
Take care.